Hi, everyone. This is Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and today I'm talking with my husband, actually, Rich Dolan. We're going to be talking about the X Conference that we attended last week in Gaithersburg, Maryland. This was a conference on exopolitics. Any of you are interested in UFOs, this is the next stage. Once you believe UFOs exist, you believe they're here, how do we talk to them? What do we say to them? How do we decide what we want to say? This is what exopolitics is all about. And this conference is the brainchild of political activist Stephen Bassett. Rich Dolan did give a presentation last week called The Revolution Has Not Been Televised, brought down the house, if I may say. He did talk about exopolitics, about the history of government's response to UFO reports, and where we should go in the future. Okay, Rich, are you here?
I'm right here, Karen. Thank you for having me on. We're having a connection problem right now, hoping that our producer can hook Karen's line back up sometime in the near future. Meanwhile, yes, I'm right here on the line. Let me just say that the X Conference, which took place a week ago in Gaithersburg, right near Washington, D.C., was, let's just say, a very interesting conference. Steve Bassett really has worked tirelessly on this to get it going. But this is the third such conference that he had. He had one in 2004, which kind of opened everything up, and then another one in 2005. It's not easy to make money on these conferences, and Steve really had to struggle to get funding for this next one in 2007. He was finally able to get some good financial backing, and then he's actually now planning to do another one in the spring of 2008. The whole purpose of these X conferences, as Steve would be the first to say, is to raise awareness of the UFO issue right in the backyard of the Washington, D.C. power political network, raise consciousness, and maybe get some action going in the form of public statements by responsible officials.
Steve invited several speakers from all over the world this time. He wanted to highlight the fact that this is really a worldwide phenomenon. This is not just something that's happening in the United States. He brought in speakers from the UK. He brought in Nick Pope from the UK. He had Antonio Hinez from Chile, Gilda Fordes from France, Paula Harris of Italy. Oh, gosh. We have people from all over. Rich, who else did we?
You mentioned Gildas. I don't know. We should have the list in front of us. It might make life a little bit easier. I'd like to talk a little bit about my own theme, which was the revolution has not been televised. Some of you may recognize it as a play on the classic song by Gil Scott Heron, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." What has happened, I think, in the last 30, 35 years of the UFO phenomenon is that control over this has moved further and further away from responsible political officials. We are still trying to get our phone system back up. Maybe a producer can contact Karen on her phone so we can do this a little more easily. Guys, if you're listening. So my whole take on it has been always to emphasize the kind of the runaway nature of secrecy and how increasingly what we're finding is that the way to look at UFO secrecy is not to see it as classified, but rather to see it as proprietary. We're moving into a very, very strange world in which all of the political truths that we grew up with, that we think of, you know, when we go into our little elementary class and we go into our civics lessons, you know, you vote for your Congress member and they vote on different issues and you have checks and balances. That's not the system that we are living in today. So what we have is something very different. And it's difficult for us to understand because it doesn't really get a lot of official recognition. So there aren't a lot of media people and aren't a lot of academic people really trying to work through what's actually been happening, which is essentially the loss of our traditional political institutions, which are increasingly under the control of very, very wealthy, powerful private interests. Now, this same phenomenon has occurred within the UFO secret. So what I'm trying to do is to look at two things. One is the UFO aspect of the problem, but also seeing it in the broader context of the privatization of the whole political system.
We're going to take a very brief break, folks. We might be able to fix the technical problem, so hang with us for just a moment. We're going to take this out and come back and pick up with what Rich was talking about. Hang on just a moment. Rich?
Yes. Right here. Are we back?
Okay, we are back on. Thanks so much for your patience, everybody. Sorry about that.
Let's get that little bit of unpleasantness far behind us. Now we've got some technical capability. So
yeah, the technology. Okay,
yes.
Rich, you were talking about something really fascinating.
Well, I was talking about really the theme of my presentation last week in Gaithersburg, which was simply that, you know, I've spent the last couple of years now of my life working on this new book of mine and trying to figure out how does UFO secrecy really work. I don't pretend that I've got all the answers, but one thing that I've really determined is that it doesn't work the way I thought it did when I started all this business 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago when I was writing my book. I assumed that there was a government apparatus that was more or less responsible for all of this, and the more I look into this, the more I really think that responsible government people are increasingly out of the loop. And what you have is a kind of private, let's call them rogue, group that has gained access to the knowledge and also to the acquired technology of UFOs. This is the kind of message Stephen Greer was giving many years ago. He kept calling these people rogue organizations too, and I must say that I think that that's the right way to look at it.
And Stephen Greer was at this conference last week as well. I'm not sure if we mentioned his name at the beginning.
That's right. Greer was there. He made a brief appearance, and he was there. He gave a talk. A little bit about this, and a little bit about energy, and a little bit about the nature of the aliens. And here's where the X conference really becomes interesting, because what you find is that factions among the exo-political speakers and attendees are already developing. I saw this throughout the whole weekend. And I tried, though I wanted, to sort of ride all factions and kind of help to be a unifying influence. It's very difficult, because really what we find with exopolitics are you have two groups of people who are involved in this, it seems, and it all comes down to how you interpret the aliens themselves. Let's call them aliens. There are people in exopolitics. Greer is one. Alfred Weber is another. To a certain extent, I might be inclined to include Michael Sala, who have opinions on these extraterrestrials or these aliens. These opinions tend to be fairly positive. In the case of someone like Alfred Weber, a man that I like very much, he has an opinion, though, that I'm not comfortable with. It's an opinion that says, you know, these extraterrestrials are, as he calls them, upper-dimensional ethical entities, and that it's their job is in the field of exopolitics, that is trying to create a political a politics of extraterrestrials, that we need to reach out in a, I guess, in a friendly way and in a more evolved way, to become part of what he has called many times a kind of galactic federation. Now, when I hear things,
that's a lot like Star Trek.
It does sound like Star Trek, and I have problems with this. Whether or not it's even true, but the thing is, I don't know that it's true. What I do know is that when we start making statements like this in a public forum, especially when you're trying to get news media to listen to you, you're very much in danger of losing your credibility. But that's been one side of this exopolitics for all this all this while.
Now, and you can understand when you're coming at this whole thing, when you're, the whole premise of their thought is that we need to treat these aliens respectfully and we need to develop a policy on how we're going to interact with them. I can see how that would go along with having a positive view of them and of their intentions here.
Right, exactly, exactly.
What bothers me is that it seems to leave out the entire possibility that they might not have positive intentions.
Well,
they might not have good intentions,
right,
toward us. And, I mean, we don't assume every human we meet is going to have good intentions when we first meet with them.
I'm disturbed when I hear people like Stephen Greer take this position to such an extreme when you bring up the phenomenon of abductions with him. Because his position about extraterrestrials is that they are good and that therefore they don't abduct people. And he says anytime you have an abduction claim that's real, it's military. I mean, every time.
Yeah. I can't.
It's not empirical. All you have to do is read the data, read the literature. If someone at this point who's been studying the UFO field is really going to argue that there are no such things as abductions, then I would have to take issue with that.
Yeah.
Because I don't see the data that way.
How long has Stephen Greer been saying so definitively that if they're abductions, then they're not aliens because only humans would do that, aliens are too good?
Stephen Greer has been involved in the UFO field in a public way for just about 20 years, really since the late 1980s. And
but
to my knowledge,
he's been saying this the whole time, has he?
Well, I don't think that he has ever said anything that gives abductions any credence. I don't think that he has ever done that.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I know that in the early 1990s, at the very least, he was already at odds with people like Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs about the nature of abduction. So,
and they're like the opposite end of the spectrum. They really don't have anything nice to say about it.
Right, they're exactly the opposite end. So this is the problem with the exopolitical field in general. You know, you don't have to call it a problem. I mean, there are always going to be different opinions. But when someone like myself hears again and again some of the people talking about these aliens as being good, or the extraterrestrials as good, it's almost like a slam dunk for them. They don't bother to consider that there are those of us who don't agree with this necessarily. So,
which is not good politics, really. How are you supposed to deal with an alien life form respectfully when we can't even treat each other respectfully? And, you know, if someone has ideas that you don't agree with, then fine. If you believe someone is incorrect, then you talk with them and you try to give them information. I mean, if I talk to someone about something that I believe they have their facts incorrect, I will try to explain it to them and maybe give them some more factual information that they may not have had access to. Not just turn my back on them or say, well, you're just completely wrong. And
yeah, well, that's what Stephen Greer does do. And in Weber's defense, I don't think he really... I would like to talk with Alfred about... you know, what he thinks regarding, say, abductions. And, because it seems to me that, you know, there's something to be concerned about with these aliens. If nothing else, the fact that they're doing everything by stealth is something that I'm not particularly comfortable with. Now, they're not the only stealthy, group involved in this. The U.S. government's been stealthy and secretive about this for decades and decades. But whoever are the beings behind the UFOs themselves, they're not coming down to make some big announcement. They're doing what they do in a way that doesn't really invite mass participation by the rest of us. So inherently, you could consider it a subversive act in our civilization. They may have very good intentions. We've got a lot of problems with our civilization, so maybe what they're doing is good. But the point is, that there's a bit of uncertainty on my part.
One could argue that things have not been getting much better. So whatever they're doing, I mean, they've been here for some time. Once you start looking at the evidence, I realize I'm saying things that people who are not familiar with the UFO literature are going to think, oh my God, she's gone around the bend on this one. But really, once you get into it and you read the literature and you do some studying, you start to accept, okay, they're real, they're here. And when you get to that point, you think, well, they've been here for a long time. If they're here to make changes and to help us, personally, I'm thinking, why aren't things looking a little better than they are? We're still in a pretty bad downward spiral from what I can see.
Well, for example, why aren't we really using Tesla technology on a wide scale? Why are we still using fossil fuels if they're really here to help us out?
Mm-hmm.
We've had, some people have argued that we've had the capability to have some serious Tesla technology in our civilization for decades and decades, maybe generations.
Mm-hmm.
So where is it? Well, if it's being held back, who are the groups holding it back? Maybe there's a secret, cabal of humans that don't want Tesla technology coming out to the masses. Okay, maybe. So where's ET in all of this? Are they really here to help us or not?
Mm-hmm.
The whole point of what I would say about exopolitics is I don't like definitive statements by anybody when they start talking about the nature of extraterrestrials. No one knows. I don't know. You don't. Nobody does. So I just would like to see a little more caution on the part of those who talk about exopolitics. And my feeling is I've never really been comfortable with exopolitics as a concept. I'm more interested in one step at a time. The next step would be some kind of openness. Some call it disclosure. Fine. Let's do that. So let's try to learn more about what is actually going on before we begin to start pontificating on how we know these non-humans are. We don't know.
Well, we don't. But I can see the argument for saying, we better get going on an exopolitical policy because, what if the time comes when suddenly we need to start dealing with them? What if the day comes when they do come out in the open and they want to talk to us?
All right, I'm down with that, but then how does one even do that?
And that's the point of the exopolitics. That's why some people say we need to come up with a policy now.
But who's the we? I mean, Michael Salas talked about citizen diplomacy. Well, I'd like to know a little bit more what is meant by this. Like you and me just trying to contact extraterrestrials. I mean, what is up with that? How is that supposed to work? Okay, some people on this planet are kind of crazy, frankly, and they're kind of dumb, and they're not always they're not people that I would necessarily want speaking on behalf of humanity in any way.
Well, that's exactly the problem we're dealing with. I mean, just because they're here, why do we assume that any one alien that we talk to or that we contact is representing his entire race or planet or dimension?
What we really need, we need a dramatic reform of our political system. We need a functioning, representative, democratic state in which we have responsible elected leaders who are actually elected and who are actually responsible and who answer to the people, and they bleed. Okay? I'm perfectly fine with that. I'm actually not a believer in total anarchy. So I would like to see a functioning governmental system. Now, we don't really have a functioning governmental system. We have a myth of a government.
Do you think it's possible to have a functioning system again?
We need to have a massive revolutionary change. That's really what we need. Things have gone.
You heard it here first, everybody. Rich Dolan is calling for a revolution.
I am. Now, the thing is, I don't want to be irresponsible about it and just say, let's burn down the Bastille and start chopping off heads. I do believe that we're going to get to that point. I believe that because our society is moving so rapidly into something completely different. It's very unstable. One thing that's happening right now is that the dollar is collapsing. Right now the dollar is in the toilet and it's only being waiting to be flushed. The US dollar is now on exact parity with the Canadian dollar. And let that sink in to anyone who's listening to this.
Yeah, I can't remember any time in my life when that has been the case.
It was briefly the case in 1976, so it was. But
okay, so I wasn't paying attention then. That was mom and dad's job then.
It did happen briefly, and business. Typically, the dollar is quite a bit stronger than the Canadian dollar.
Oh, God, I just told everybody how old I am.
Well, that's all right.
Okay, never mind.
And the dollar is getting killed right now against the euro. It's getting killed against the yen. It's getting killed against every currency. There are reasons for this. I don't want to bring in a lot of irrelevancies, but the point is this. If the U.S. economy and if the U.S. dollar goes the way that I believe it's going, the way it looks, we're going to have very, very bad times ahead in this country, and there's going to be a lot of pissed off people, and they're going to want answers about a lot of things. And God forbid for the elected, for the political system, if the UFO secret comes out during the middle of all of that. Because if there's going to be hell to pay for the economy, there's going to be big hell to pay for all these other secrets. And once it's seen by people that they don't have a government, what they have is a kind of modern version of a feudal state in which a few individuals own everything, then we have a real chance for true political reform. And that's something that we really need. And if we're going to deal with extraterrestrials in any kind of coherent way, that's something we need too. This citizen diplomacy, I'm not getting it. Maybe I need to learn about it, but
How did Michael Sala bring up the concept of the citizen diplomacy? I remember hearing part of that presentation.
He mentioned it, but didn't really explain it. I mean, what he said was, well, this has been a common thing now for the last 10 years, but all right, I'll confess to be ignorant about this. I don't know how this would work in the context of UFOs. I mean, sure, there are non-governmental organizations. Maybe that's what he meant, NGOs. These are very widespread. They're important. They have a big part to play in a lot of modern international politics. It's true, the growth of NGOs. So if that's what he means, then that's good. That's cool. And what we could do is create our own kind of non-governmental organization devoted to the exopolitical issue, and that's something that Michael is trying to do. I credit him for that. So, but this is, it's tough. I mean, you have to find out who you're dealing with. And one thing that we need to do is recognize the human system that we're dealing with to some extent, because there are secrets that these humans have, and the question is finding who's got them. Enough of the secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who have got information on this. I'm quite sure of it. But getting it. For example, I'll give you a for instance. I'm in communication with a number of very interesting people these days. On my own, I'm just emailing and calling and talking to a lot of people, trying to get some answers about who's in charge. I have one person who is very, very, knows a lot of things. And this person is almost, I would say, depressed over the fact that the secrecy is so intense that being able to get the information out about who are the people who actually have information on this, to start spilling the beans is dangerous. For insiders.
It's dangerous for them.
It's dangerous, that's right, for any leaker involved. It's a scary thought. I've mentioned a number of times about my correspondence with astronaut Edgar Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
I'll mention it here. Close to a year ago now, I'm thinking.
For anyone who doesn't realize, Edgar Mitchell actually wrote a comment which was printed on the cover of your book.
That's true.
UFOs in the national security state. There may be a few people listening who haven't come across your book yet.
Yeah, and read my book, people.
Buy the book. Don't just read it.
If every one of you, there's probably about, 30,000 listeners, if every one of you were to buy my book, see, here's what you could then do. You could allow me to have a little bit of breathing space financially so I could finish my next book.
So
you'd be doing a public service.
Getting after Rich, when's the next book coming out? When will you finish the next book? Okay, buy the first one. If you already have one, buy it and give it to somebody else.
I mean, the fact that I'm not allowed to have a writer's life because I've got a million other things to do, this would allow me to have a writer's life again. So go to my website, keyholepublishing.com, and buy my book. Okay, anyway, back to Edgar Mitchell,
yes.
Who was the first major person to, the first well-known person to endorse my book. But Edgar Mitchell, for about a decade, has made a variety of public statements about the nature of UFO secrecy. One, the thing that he has said was that he has a couple of upper-level contacts, high-level. I mean, think, you know, this is a moonwalking astronaut, so he's got the highest-level people that he can talk to. And that these people have said to him that there are secret, very secret programs to study alien technology and alien bodies. Edgar Mitchell has said this. Whether or not the man is right or wrong, think about how important that is.
The fact that someone of his stature has come out and publicly said this.
That's right.
Several times. And no one has picked it up.
Well, the thing is, it's gotten occasional local, like, well, one time a local Florida newspaper covered it, and that was it. Another time, he made a statement at, like a MUFON conference or some kind of UFO conference, and it was reported in the MUFON Journal, which has a total circulation of like 2,000, you know, big deal. But these statements are out there, and he's gone on the public record. That's the important thing. And he's done it repeatedly over a 10-year period. So last fall, I wrote to him, and I mean, Edgar Mitchell's in his mid-70s, okay? No one's getting any younger here. I said, look, you've made these statements several times. You're on public record. I don't want you to give up these names for me, necessarily. I said, but I'm hoping, paraphrase, I said, you know, maybe you can throw me a bone here and point me in a direction or say, give me a statement that I can use that would be helpful or give me a lead that I can follow up on. Anything, please. Mm-hmm. And he said, look, I really can't do that. The people who came to me, he said, did so at great professional and personal risk, and he also said, and risk to their families. And he said, I can't. I mean, as long as they're still alive, I cannot give up their name. I just can't do it. Now, this other, I have another contact who's about of a similar stature as Edgar Mitchell, frankly, who said, I understand that because I'm in the exact same situation. I've had connections that have given me very, very sensitive information. And I can't give these people up because if I do, that's bad for everyone. So this is the situation they're in. It's something very, very serious, very dangerous. One thing Stephen Greer has said that his sources have told him, and I'm inclined to believe this, is that there's a kind of, if you want to talk about what is MJ-12, you know, the super control group over UFOs, well, he says there is an MJ-12, and that it's international, it's not just the government thing anymore, and that they have a lot of money and a lot of guns. So that if you start really getting too close, according to Greer or his sources, they'll just kill you. Or they'll get your family, or some bad thing. And I believe that a lot of these insiders are afraid of that. They're afraid of bad things happening to their family. So with that kind of a fear, it's going to be very hard to get something definite and confirmable out of these people. But we're also getting the idea that this is a very serious and indeed maybe even grave matter. I mean, this much secrecy for this many years, you know it's got to be something important.
But doesn't that imply also that it's something that's going to have to come out at some point? I mean, why? Most secrets aren't intended to be kept forever.
Right.
Or indefinitely. Usually it's like, well, keep this quiet until something.
Yeah,
until
right, I agree.
Until we have complete control over something, or until something else happens. I mean,
I think secrets remain secret until they either become irrelevant when they don't need to be kept anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like 100 years ago, remember the Maine, you know, the event that sparked the Spanish-American War. This is so ridiculous. An American ship off the coast of Cuba was supposedly bombed by a Spanish torpedo. And this was the cause célèbre. Well, it turns out to have not been the case at all. The Spaniards didn't attack the American ship. But we didn't learn about that until after it was totally irrelevant, after all the issues relating to the Spanish-American War were no longer applying and no one cared. Okay, had we known when it mattered, it would have had a very different outcome.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just the nature of secrets in general. The UFO secret remains important. There's like the Kennedy assassination, still important. That's why the official establishment has to continue to lie about the Kennedy assassination. I believe people who were involved in killing Kennedy are still basically the same people who are in power today. I believe that killing Kennedy was a coup of sorts. And I think with the UFO secret, with the 9/11 secret, these are important secrets, and they have a lot of power for those who are holding them.
Now, do you think that once all the people who were involved in the Kennedy assassination, and we're going on the assumption here, what I believe to be true is that, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald did not have anything to do with it, assuming there was a larger conspiracy, do you believe that once all of those people who were actually there that day, who were directly involved in it, once they're dead, do you think the story might come out, or would the secret then pass on to the next generation of younger politicians or other people who found out about it later and kept quiet?
Well, I think that it won't come out for a while, because I don't think it's the people so much as the organizations or groups that are responsible.
Mm-hmm.
So it has been argued, and there's a lot of Kennedy assassination theories that are out there. I don't really know which one is the true one. There's a UFO connection, actually, that's been made, not too badly. There's the connection that the Federal Reserve had Kennedy killed. It's not a bad argument.
Can you give us just a quick overview for anyone who isn't familiar with those theories?
Sure. Well, the UFO connection is based on the recovery of a disputed document, admittedly, but it's a disputed document that I think looks compelling. I've talked to Nick Redfern about it, who studies a lot, and he thinks it looks compelling, too. It's a document that is connected with Marilyn Monroe, and basically talking about Marilyn Monroe's knowledge of UFOs and aliens through her liaison with President Kennedy. And
this document says that Kennedy knew something about UFOs and aliens, and that he let it slip to Monroe, and that she was going to talk about it.
Exactly. Yeah, this is during August of 1962, right before she was killed. So the implication is that Marilyn Monroe was killed, and I think she certainly was killed. If that document's legitimate, then she was very likely killed over the UFO issue. And if she was killed over the UFO issue, how much of a stretch is it to think that Kennedy might have been killed over the same thing? Anyway, there's a reason to wonder about the UFO connection, which is, as many people call it, the elephant in the living room. So it's a big, big presence in our history that's really not gotten the attention it deserves. The Federal Reserve connection to the Kennedy assassination is simply that the Federal Reserve was created just before World War I, and it was created in a really sneaky way, shoved through Congress. People think of the Federal Reserve as a part of the government, which really it isn't. It's privately owned entirely. Before the creation of the Federal Reserve, if the President or Congress wanted to raise tax money so that the government could do things, they would authorize the spending, and then Congress would authorize the creation of any money that were to be printed. So, in other words, the whole thing, the entire U.S. currency was directly under the control of the American government. With the creation of the Federal Reserve, that ceased. And what happened next was that the Federal Reserve, which was a collection of privately owned banks, would be responsible for making the money, giving the money to the U.S. government to spend, and then getting paid back by the U.S. government with interest. Okay? So what a nice gig that is. You're the lender to the United States government every year.
Why don't we get into things like this, where people just, you know, print up money and give it to us? How come I never seem to fall into that kind of a job?
Yeah.
You know, I have had so many jobs, I have never had one like that.
Well, we're not big enough and powerful enough yet. So that's the whole thing with the Federal Reserve, and what that has done is, when you think about it, it's an inherently inflationary thing, because if nothing else, you're not creating your currency. The Federal Reserve determines its interest rate. Okay. Now, it's true that the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who is appointed by the president, so there is a political appointment there, theoretically is trying to do things that are going to be helpful for the American economy, which is ultimately helpful for the Federal Reserve.
Okay, but in the case of during the time of Kennedy, it was not working?
Well, what happened with Kennedy, Kennedy, along with many other presidents, have had problems with the existence of the Federal Reserve. And during his presidency, I believe it was in 1963, John F. Kennedy authorized the creation of currency notes that were independent of the Federal Reserve system. Okay, now I don't know all of the details of this. This is available for research. It really isn't my...
I suspect a lot of our listeners are wondering what this has to do with exopolitics.
Well, we're just going off into conspiracies here.
Yeah.
And secrecy. So let's come back to where we were going. I talked about Kennedy, I talked about 9/11. You were asking about why are secrets kept.
Exactly.
And the whole point is that secrets are kept as long as they're profitable for those people who want to keep the secret. And if they're able to, they'll do the best. Now, here's the other side of it, though. We're in a very turbulent era. If it were up to the secret keepers, they'd just keep things the way they are forever and ever and ever. But, of course, time just keeps going. So nothing is stable. Everything is up for grabs. And I have believed for a long time now that we are on the cusp of something radically different within the next, I don't know, take your pick, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years or so, most. We're going to be looking at a very, very different kind of society. And it's my belief that the UFO issue is going to look very, very different when we get out on the other side of it. I don't know how it's going to look, but I firmly believe it's going to look very different. And we're going to be looking at new questions. And that those questions will be likely forcing some kind of open acknowledgement of the reality of this by government officials. And this does matter. Some people think, well, who cares if the government admits it or not? We know it's true. But you see, I think the government does matter. Because if I believe in any one thing, I believe that it's our duty as citizens of what's supposed to be a free society to take control over our government and to make it responsive to what we are all about. And if it's not being responsive to us on the UFO issue, then we got a really big disconnect here. We got a big problem. So I think part of our job, part of the job of exopolitics, in my opinion, should be to force our government to be responsive on this issue so that we can then move forward, hopefully with some intelligent action.
Well, that is one of the things that Steve Bassett intended. I know that's something he had in mind when he put this conference together, because he does want to bring this issue to the attention of the government and bring to their attention also the interest held in this subject by American citizens and by individuals around the world. And he wants us all to go there and to show our politicians and our elected officials that we do take this seriously, and we would like them to deal with this question and not just keep brushing it off.
Indeed we do. My disagreement with Steve, who's a very good friend of mine, has been in the tactics that we're using. I just have not been supportive of the idea of putting front row center this concept, basically the concept of Alfred Weber, which is that, we already know what these aliens are like. They're good. Let's establish friendly relationships with them. This is putting the cart before the horse, in my opinion, and it makes it so easy for the mainstream media to lampoon us, which in fact is what happened. After the conference ended, we did a press conference at the National Press Club. You and I were both there. I spoke at it. And, there were some very low-key, credible individuals who spoke. Nick Pope, former Minister of Defense official, was there. And Nick sounded very good. Captain Robert Salas was there. Robert was at the Malmstrom Air Force Base when a UFO hovered over his position and shut down 20 nuclear missiles. Good grief. We've got documentation on this that's very, very strong. And plus, Robert is just the kind of person who you'd love to have representing you in this. He's so professional and low-key. I myself discussed UFO documents that are not arguable. They're released documents showing that this is a phenomenon that's real by our own military.
And you had the documents there.
I had the documents there. I was showing them on camera. And yet, I hate saying this because it's going to make me sound like I don't like some of these people, but I have a problem when, you know, the Washington Post reporter singled out two individuals other than Steve's interview. Okay, he didn't ask me, he didn't ask Nick, he didn't ask Robert Salas, he didn't ask Don Schmidt, who had a lot to say about Roswell and sounded good about that. No. He interviewed Alfred Weber, and he interviewed Robert Miles, the producer of Fast Walkers. Now you'd think, well, Fast Walkers was a good documentary.
Actually, it was. It was fantastic.
Robert Miles, however, was not at his best. We'll just put it that way. Mm-hmm. He was not at his best all weekend, and it was very evident to anybody who saw. And those are the two people that the Washington Post reporter explicitly went after.
He didn't just accidentally happened to come across those two first. He made a note of it.
He looked for them. That's right.
And he
wrote up a hatchet piece. He wrote a pure hatchet piece.
Yeah.
So what is that? Does that mean that's good publicity? Well, any publicity is good publicity. Well, if they're making fun of you every damn time you do this, I don't know that that's good publicity. I don't know that that's something that we really want. That makes us look like fools. So, you know, my argument about the whole exopolitical tactic is it's very easy. You know, we're putting people out there who are very, very easy targets. And,
this columnist went after the supporters as well. Instead of referring to supporters who came along with the speakers to this press conference, he didn't call us the supporters. He called us conventioneers.
Yeah, it was the whole thing was very...
I mean, it sounded like we were throwing confetti and drinking champagne and all wearing little pink whale hats. I mean, it wasn't a convention right now.
The thing is, you can argue that no matter what we do, that reporters like that, Dana Milbank, by the way, was the reporter, that they're going to try to make fun of us. And I'm sure that that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But why put your head on a chopping block and make it easy for him? There's no point. Don't give them things to make fun of. We could have done that. And it frustrates me. I'm at the point where after the conference, I actually doubted whether I wanted to do any more of these. And then I go back and forth, and I'm thinking, well, I do believe in getting my message out there. So I'm sure that I'll do it.
Well, don't you think, though, that, you know, you can say that there were people who delivered a message that was easy to grab hold of and to make fun of. Okay, but if they hadn't been there, wouldn't he have just taken someone else and made fun of them?
Well, you could say that, but the fact is that there would not have been anyone else that would have been easy to make fun of.
It might not have been easy, but I think he still would have done it.
Well, fine, then.
I mean, personally, I think if a journalist is going to go to a conference and behave the way he did, I think he intended to make fun of whatever happened.
I think that's true.
And yeah,
so
but he found something that was fairly easy to take hold of, but if he hadn't found them, he would have just gone after someone else.
Well, yeah, but let's say he would have gone after myself or after Nick Pope.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think that it would have been as easy.
He probably would have had to make up something, and I don't think, I mean, from his behavior, I'm not sure he would have, you know, balked at that.
Well, I don't know, but the thing is, if they're going to do it, then make them work at it. Don't just give it to them.
Yeah, well, even the thing about referring to people who came along with the speakers as conventioneers, that was a simple little thing, and it stripped the whole thing I mean, calling people supporters would have said, oh, my God, and look at all these people who came with them.
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, if you're, think of it as a skeptical mainstream reporter. You're asked to report on this press conference. You probably don't want to go to begin with, right? So you're in there, and you hear people like Alfred talking about the necessity of us to have positive relations with upper-dimensional ethical entities. Talking in all seriousness about this, and you're, you know, Washington Post, you're sitting in the back row, you're thinking, what the hell is this all about? Upper-dimensional ethical, what? You gotta think these people are crazy. You know, it's like, where is he coming from with all this stuff?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was very easy. All that we had to do is just take one step at a time, don't get greedy, don't overreach, and just make a case. This is the problem that Stephen Greer did in his famous press conference of 2001. I've said this on blue in the face, and I'll say it again. That whole conference was guilty of overreach. You know, it's one thing to make a case that UFOs are real when you're talking in front of the whole world. That's a lot of work for one day.
So if you had been running this press conference, you would have stopped at making the point that there's something there and the public wants to hear about it?
That's right. I would have hammered home one point, and that point is that we have sufficient military government documentation to show that there's something going on and that someone's covering this up, and we have a right to know what it is. We start talking about who these other ETs are, or initiatives to establish our own diplomatic, you know, whatever. It just seemed very unprofessional to me. It seemed amateuristic. And it's gonna be very hard for professional people in Washington, New York, and the big cities where big people make these decisions.
Yeah.
They're not gonna take us seriously. We just look very, very, rustic when we're out there.
Yeah,
and this isn't the time to look rustic anymore.
No, and the truth was, when, you know, I was sitting there at that press conference, and I was looking across the panel and thinking about the people who were up there and the credentials that these people had, and, boy, you'd be hard-pressed to find people like this gathered together at probably any of the other meetings there, thinking we've got, you know, PhDs, and we've got military, you know, retired military officers.
Yeah,
and
yeah. There are good people
30,
who are involved.
40 years studying this, and, you know, these are not stupid people. Not at all. Not anything like the way they were portrayed in
No, but the message that, I mean, once Steve was done talking, Steve also really overreached a bit in his own presentation, I have to say, and then Alfred came on. So it was like a 1-2. Mm-hmm. Alfred really made it hard for any mainstream journalists to take the rest of this seriously. And then, before it was over, Robert Miles got on and that was the final nail in the coffin. Steve had to lead Robert Miles off the podium. And I know for sure that when he did that, Milbank, the reporter, told his assistant, he says, we have to interview that guy, the one Bassett's leading off the stage.
You don't think he was just saying, oh, this guy's got something to say that I didn't hear?
He sounded crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, Miles sounded crazy out there.
Who the hell's
going to want to interview him for actual, genuine... What?
Just for the benefit of the people listening to us who weren't there.
Because if
I hadn't been there and I heard this discussion that you and I are having, I'd be thinking, oh, he was trying to say something, they stopped him. As a journalist, I would want to hear what was the rest of it.
No, he sounded like he was having an emotional episode of some sort, frankly.
Yeah.
Lacking self-control, and it was an embarrassment, okay? So, now everyone else was very good. Everyone else was very good. But this is, it just kills me to think about what happened, because I love Steve, and I believe in the cause. The cause is getting the UFO topic out there, and in a way that we can acknowledge and then get to the bottom of, in terms of our own government.
Right.
It's not just finding out who these aliens are, it's getting control back of our political system. The people that I've talked
to... That's the biggest point of this whole thing, is that government, our government is supposed to be serving us, and it's not.
It's the most important thing for me. Honestly, I'm interested in the reality, let's say, of non-humans or aliens that are here, but I'm more concerned. I mean, why would I care if aliens are here if I live in a sham of a free society? Why the hell would I give a crap about these other aliens that are here when my own society is no longer free? If I can't live fully free the way that we all deserve to be.
Yeah.
All right, so that's what matters to me. And so that the UFO secret is, it's really, it's a way for me to try to have my hand at getting that back. And so what we need to do is to use the UFO secret as a way to, or uncovering that secret rather, as a way of getting back our freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we're going to succeed, but that is the job that lays before us for those of us who choose to take it.
Okay, and on that note, we are going to take a break for a few minutes. This is Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest today is Richard Dolan, who spoke last weekend at the X Conference in Gaithersburg, Maryland, right outside Washington, D.C. The conference was concerning exopolitics, which for that weekend was taken to mean two different things. One is getting the government to talk about what they know about UFOs and ETs and what they've been keeping secret, and also formulating a policy for humans to be communicating with ETs or interdimensional beings or whatever they may turn out to be. So don't go away, everyone. We're going to take a couple of minutes break, and we will be right back. Okay. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest today is Richard Dolan, who spoke last week at the X Conference, the Exopolitics Conference, in Gaithersburg, Maryland, right outside Washington, D.C. For anyone who's just joining us right now, exopolitics was used at this conference to mean two different things. One was learning how to set a policy, or actually setting a policy, for communicating with beings from elsewhere, either extraterrestrial, extra-dimensional, whatever the pilots of these UFOs may turn out to be. And the other focus was also on disclosure, on getting our government to fess up and release information that they've been hiding concerning the nature of these UFOs and ETs for the past, 60 years, going back to Roswell, maybe farther.
Yeah, right. 60 years is, this is now 60 years since Roswell's time. It's a pretty good breaking up point.
Before the break, we were talking about the press conference that was held following the X conference, and we started talking about a couple of specific speakers, and I did get a question about one of the speakers that I wanted to pass on to Rich.
Okay.
We were talking about Robert Miles, who made the documentary Fast Walker, which I thought was terrific.
I agree. It was very good.
One person did mention, I'm looking for the comment. Here we go. One person said, I wonder if Miles is even aware of the fact that Rich Giordano, who was on the Fast Walkers DVD, made a video confession on YouTube in which he confessed to taking certain UFO videos. Now, I had not heard anything about this. Had you heard of it?
No, I hadn't. Entirely possible, and people do make fakes. So I wasn't involved in any way, really, with Robert. He interviewed me for Fast Walkers, and I did my little thing. But as far as allegations of hoaxing, no, I think the person who made the suggestion, I would love, actually, if they would be able to send me an email, and I'd be interested in following up, just learning a little bit more about it. Probably something I should have known, but so many hours in a day.
Exactly, and you're involved in so many different things. You do have people sending you so much information.
Well, I do, but it's something I'd like to know. So my email address is keyhole@rochester.rr.com. That's keyhole, just like looking for a keyhole.
And or like the name of this show is Through the Keyhole.
Exactly. So send me something. I would be interested in knowing what you know. I mean, I could hunt down the person on YouTube, I'm sure, but links are always nice.
Yeah. Now, I just want to point out, I mean, for myself at least, and probably for most people hearing this, I mean, the fact that one person who was involved, who was filmed for this documentary, has confessed to hoaxing or faking certain videos, certainly, I mean, maybe in some people's minds it would then cast doubt on the others, but in my mind it really doesn't, because these people are all very, very separate.
There are. There is a history of hoaxes in the UFO field going all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
It does happen. There are people who get their rocks off, their jollies on things they can fool a whole bunch of other people and showing them how smart they are.
Right, but my point is that doesn't mean that anyone
right.
else who was filmed for the same documentary is therefore dishonest.
Exactly, and on the same token, there are many, many cases of UFO evidence that's clearly not hoax, that clearly shows very anomalous types of things. So the fact that there are people who hoax, that muddies the waters and makes it difficult for guys like me or you, Karen, who are now involved in this, trying to get to the bottom of it.
Okay, we do have another question. We have someone's hand up, and I would like to take this question live, so I'm going to turn this over to our producer, Joe, and hopefully we'll be able to get this person on the air with us.
Great. Any time would be good.
Hey. Hey, Dee.
Hi, Dee. I've not even been sure that exopolitics is a valid concept. So it's hard for me to say what it should be when I'm not even sure that it should exist. Assuming it exists, you know, there is a definition that Michael Sala offered that I think is pretty good. And I'm paraphrasing him because I don't have it in front of me, but really the study of institutions that are connected with extraterrestrial reality. So in other words, it means understanding our government, as I see it, in the context of ET and its relationship, or our relationship with ET, however we can understand what that is. So that's kind of vague, that's kind of... And, you know, here's the thing. I'm not really seeing a lot of... analysis. Sala is doing some of this, I will admit, trying to figure out what that relationship might be. But for example, there's a whole, you know, mountain of rumors about the deal that went wrong back in the 50s and 60s. I think a lot of people know what I'm talking about. The alleged deal that Dwight Eisenhower made with aliens back in 1954, that has been alleged again and again, which was to get extraterrestrial technology in return for the aliens having access to human beings every now and then to abduct them and then put them safely back. This has been alleged for a long time. To my knowledge, I think the earliest allegation was by William Cooper back in the late 80s. There may be earlier allegations. And so investigating things like that, that would be an exopolitical question, whether or not that's true. I'm not saying it is or isn't. That's an exopolitical issue. I look at black budget spending as an exopolitical issue, if you want to include it within that. Black budget spending to the extent that it has anything to do with extraterrestrial. And I think it's, for example, I happen to believe that there's strong evidence, this is
going into my next book, that we are building our own flying saucers. And I believe we're doing them out west, out in what's often called Antelope Valley, Aviation Valley, according to some, out in California desert. I think that there's good evidence to argue this, that all the billions and billions of dollars that people like Captain Austin Fitz have been talking about is going missing. I think a lot of it's going down there, and I think they drink down the billions the way a wino drinks down his alcohol. Okay, and they don't even, there's a lot of money that's gone down there. So, that's exopolitics. There are many, many claims of people who have had interactions with these other beings. These are claims that would go under exopolitics if we can find a way to further investigate and get to the bottom of it. I think we can do that, we'll have a better chance of doing that if we get some openness and some disclosure about UFOs. So I really see disclosure as coming first, exopolitics realistically coming after that.
The disclosure is a necessary component to exopolitics. Really, I see exopolitics in a more narrow way than you do, I guess, because I really see it just as figuring out what is our policy going to be on how we deal with this other group.
Yeah, fine. I have no problem with that.
Well,
because
right.
We're just talking about terms anyway.
Well, exactly. And
all these things are important.
It was a really good question, Dee, because, you know, as Steve pointed out several times over the weekend, I heard him saying that people would say, well, I don't really know what exopolitics means. And he'd say, well, that's okay, because it's a new word. We made it up. I mean, that's how words come into being, and it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you break it down, it's, you know, it's politics, it's interaction. Exo is with that group out there.
Right, right.
Which, you know, it's a perfectly valid word, but very few people are familiar with it. So, yeah, at this point, we do all have different ideas about what it should mean.
I mean, if we got to the point where, let's say, the rays of sunshine beam down and we learn the important truth that there are many alien groups that are here. Let's say that there are. I think that there are, actually, and I'll bet most of the listeners to this program probably believe that.
You know,
so let's say that that's
true.
The
first time I ever heard that concept, though, I remember thinking, I mean, I heard somebody talking about it, and I saw a notebook on a table that said, you know, here are the 50 different races that are here,
right,
and I
right.
thought, oh my gosh, somebody here is a Fruit Loop. And
well,
you know what?
Right.
But I've had time to get used to the idea, and I think I was incredibly narrow-minded. But it's
well,
an idea to get your brain around it first. It
takes time to have all these concepts sink in.
Exactly. I'm sorry, go on.
If there's more than one alien group here for the long term, and I believe that that's true, then certainly one of the key exopolitical questions would have to be, how do we, human beings, human society, choose to have a relationship with the different groups, assuming they don't all necessarily get along that well? I mean, what if they don't? Ah, then we're in a bit of a sticky-wicky. We have to figure out what we're going to do, what our relationships will be. Now, frankly, it's premature. Now, we can assume, though, let's pretend that some of the things we think we know turn out to be true. So let's pretend that there are these entities that can be channeled that are good, that seem to be good. At least the people who are in contact with them may, you know, feel that this is the case. Let's say that there are greys and reptilians who are kind of nasty and are abducting people and putting implants in them as well. So I'm going to guess that if we are out in the open with these relationships, we might choose to have better relations with what Alfred called the upper dimensional ethical entities rather than the nasty greys. But nevertheless, working out a political relationship with all of these groups, that's exopolitics. And that's... But at this point, my contention is simply that that whole realm is purely speculative, or at least it's theoretical. There's really not a heck of a lot, I feel, we could do right now until we get openness from our political system on the matter. I mean, look, if we're going to need to fight somebody, then we're going to want some of the weapons that, you know, the U.S. military and the, who knows, the Illuminati have, right? So, yeah, as if they're going to let us have access to any of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think to me, the difficulty and the depressing thing about exopolitics, but the important thing about it is recognizing who are the human secret keepers themselves. Because that's a big part of this equation. You know, getting to the bottom of our own political system. Is there an Illuminati? Are there these nefarious, very, you know, powerful people who are pulling strings that we are not generally aware of? Because if they exist, then that's a big part of the equation. We need to know that they exist. And if we're going to get rid of these guys, then we've got to get rid of them. And that's what I mean there. It's not right for a small group of self-appointed rulers to do what they do in secret without the rest of us knowing about it. That's wrong. And if those people exist, then they're probably exerting a lot more influence over this whole process behind the scenes than we know about. And I don't like that either. I don't want them making my decisions for me.
Exactly. That's not the kind of political system we believe we live in. I mean, in this country, we believe we had that sort of system and we got rid of it and we set up a different one. And now we find out we never changed anything. I mean, maybe it changed temporarily, but we're back to what we started with and maybe worse.
We live in an oligarchy that masks itself as kind of free society,
mm-hmm.
and is ruled by the people. And we don't have that. We gotta. So to me, all of that is exopolitics. All of it is, at least has a relationship to exopolitics. And, you know, finding out who are the aliens. I'm interested in this, but again, it's really not, the most critical thing for me personally to be looking at.
Well, I think it is critical, actually, because I think of exopolitics as deciding how we're going to interact with this group. And in order to make that determination, we need to know as much as we can about who they are and where they came from and what they're here for.
Well, actually, okay, I take that point.
And,
so
well,
that's something that exopolitical writers should be doing, a kind of typography, a classification
right.
of the most likely extraterrestrials that are here.
Well, right, especially if you are accepting the theory that there's more than one group, and they're probably here for different things. And even, you know, every gray is probably not here for the same thing. Every reptilian is probably not here for the same thing. When we send an invasionary force into some other country, is every single person there for the same reason? Are they all, I mean, would you deal with every
single
person?
Well, in theory, yes, they would be.
Well,
but there may be more than just
one. We're talking about how to relate to people. I mean, think about even your circle of friends, even members of your immediate family. Do you deal with every single person in that small group the same way? No, because they're all different.
Right.
Even with the number of similarities they have to each other, you still don't deal with them all the same way. And so how
right.
are we supposed to come up with a policy on how we're going to interact with everyone who comes to us from other dimensions, other worlds, other planets, other galaxies? We can't even figure out how to deal with all of our friends. I mean, this is
yeah.
a huge thing, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. It's wildly important, but we need as much information as we can possibly get, and we can't do this without government disclosure. We've got to know what they know.
I keep thinking that we're going to get to a point where the government may actually become irrelevant in the sense that if we move along the road of artificial intelligence like I believe that we are moving along, that within, say, 15, 20 years tops, we're going to have capabilities privately, each person, that are just going to be astonishing. And so we may actually be able to get answers on this issue independently. That may transform the situation. I mean, keep in mind that hey, it's only been, oh, about 15 years, not even, that we've had a truly viable World Wide Web. By most estimates, the true web, you know, with graphical user interface, really didn't become a major factor until around 1993-94. Before that, there was an internet. Remember Usenet? Anyone who's old enough, all the bulletin boards. Those are still around, by the way, but back in the early 90s and before, that was the internet. But it wasn't until the early mid-90s that the web kind of took over and transformed the way that we all communicate with each other. And this was an unforeseen development, I think. So that, you know, the development of the internet has been a very, very good thing from the point of view of democratic forces and information to the people. And you see corporate forces that right now that are trying to take over that internet, dominate it themselves, but there are too many bastions of freedom on the internet too, like what we're doing. So I think that that whole process will not be over, and that another 15, 20 years, we could very well see revolutionary developments in computing technology that could really be part of this whole picture, of the exopolitical picture in ways that we can't imagine right now. When our computers have entire conversations with us and appear to be smarter than us, I mean, heck, some AI theorists are now talking about godlike levels of intelligence coming from future computers, okay? People think UFOs are whacked out. Read some good books on the future of AI. And those guys are mainstream compared with us, easily. So my point is that there are many new variables that are still and yet to assert themselves. And I don't know where I'm going with all this, but the battle's not over, in other words, and we're in a situation of total flux. So that, what's the year? We're in 2007, so by 2025, I would bet we're going to be in a completely different place.
Now, a few minutes ago, you mentioned in the future, individuals will have much more capability and will be able to get this information from other channels. And I'm not real clear on what you meant, what kind of abilities you think we'll have. Was that because of computers?
I think so. I mean, I think that the way that computing is going and electronic connectivity is going, that, I mean, we've got forces that are really pushing toward a global police state. And that's not hard to see. But there's this other force that's in place right now. And this is the force of technology. And it's not obvious to me, as cynical and as pessimistic as I often feel, I'm not 100% convinced that the internet is going to be under totalitarian control in 10, 15 years. I think that there's going to be a lot of room for breathing space on the internet. And I think that with continued developments in computing, that trend might actually accelerate. I mean, I think it's possible anyway.
Yeah. See, the difference between our two opinions is that I kind of feel like once we get up to that level of computer ability, that computers are going to stop doing what we ask them to.
Well, they might.
Which is not going to help us find out anything. Maybe the computers will be able to do it, but if they say no, it's not going to help.
They can do like in the Terminator or in the Matrix and
exactly.
Just decide that they're more intelligent than we are. That is, many computers...
Say, you know, can you give me this information? They'll say, yeah, but I don't feel like it.
Yeah, you don't have any need to know.
Exactly. I mean, honestly, I feel some days like my car does that now, so, you know, it's only a matter of time before the computer starts doing it.
It's possible. That's why AI theorists call that point the singularity, because it's just like, you know, in a black hole, there's this thing called singularity beyond which the laws of physics don't apply, so that you can't really predict what happens, I guess, that's kind of the theory. And so, too, with the development of strong AI, that beyond that point, it's like a singularity because we're unable to predict what will happen, because that intelligence is going to be greater than our own, and we don't really have predictive ability. So, it's possible. possible that they will, you know, swat us like a fly, or it's also possible that they won't, and that they might make our lives better. I would like to think that that's the case.
That would be nice.
And that we may be able to get some answers from them about a lot of things, crazy as it sounds.
Well, then the question is, will we like the answers?
Well,
some people might say it doesn't matter.
When we look around, I often ask myself, what is the capacity for truth in that we have? You often hear it said that we don't have much of a capacity for truth, that we like to lie to ourselves about things. I do believe that we live with a lot of illusions around us all the time, and that these are comfortable illusions. Who wants to be able to have to ponder the problems of the world 24/7? We like to watch ball games, we like to just watch cartoons or have fun and veg out and not think about these things. So it is possible that we have a limited capacity, but I'm always amazed by the ability of people to wake up when they're ready. People do wake up at times, and what they can discover a hunger inside them that they were not previously aware of. So I like to hold out a little bit of optimism for the human spirit, actually, from time to time. You don't sound as optimistic, Karen, if I may be so bold.
I'm not. No, I would like to be, and I wish I were, and I sincerely hope I'm wrong, but I have a really hard time dealing with thinking about how things are going to be in the future, because no matter what I would like it to be, when I think about computers being smarter than the people who are operating them, I don't understand why they would continue to do what we ask them to.
Well, you see, my opinion, I feel like this is our Hail Mary pass here. All right? It's fourth down. We're at our own goal line, man. We're screwed if we don't do something real big here.
Yeah.
And the way that our civilization is configured right now, I don't think that there's a person listening at this moment who's going to argue against the idea that we got to change something really fast. Okay? The way we're going right now is a bad road. And this is not what people would have thought 40, 50 years ago, by the way. You go back to America to 1960, and I guarantee you that 90%+ of the people of that society would have said, hey man, the world is getting better, better and better, and life is going to become more and more progressive. And sure, there's going to be problems, but we're really going to be able to work through them. That's the generation that gave us Star Trek culture. You know, the ultimate optimistic vision of our future. Right? That all came out of the 60s. We're not in that place anymore. No one is in that place. We're in a place where everyone who's got a brain is looking around us and saying, this is so totally screwed up. What are we going to do about oil? What are we going to do about jobs? Good grief. Okay, so no matter how you look at it, and then the environment, global warming and ozone and, oh, God almighty, species loss, it just gets worse and worse and worse. So the things are not good. So what is it that we're going to change? What can we change? Well, we've got to change our method of energy consumption. We can't just be using oil, and I guess we're not going to have much choice because that's running out anyway, probably.
Right. We'll be forced to find something.
We're going to be forced to, but we better get something going, because I'll tell you right now, if we don't, you're not going to have 6.5 billion people living in the world without oil unless we find a replacement. There are going to be a lot of people who are going to die, and if that many people die, that's not going to be without a massive global catastrophe, including wars and all the other bad things. So we better do something.
Well, see, if I were really, really seriously paranoid and conspiracy-minded, I might then speculate as to whether this whole war in Iraq thing is really just a population control exercise.
I believe, well, maybe, my opinion about the war in Iraq is that it's a naked attempt to gain ownership over the Iraqi oil field, which is in Iraq right now the big issue on the table. None of it is making the U.S. media. None of it. right now, because, you know, remember, before the war in Iraq, those oil fields were nationalized. They were under control of the Iraqi government, that is Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, you just knew that there was going to be a movement to put the oil fields under private ownership, privatized, which means multinational, which is the whole point. Because those oil fields are worth a lot of money. My point about needing to change is that when I look at artificial intelligence, I look at technology and computing, and the exponential growth curve that we are on right now, I'm at the point right now, it may change, but I'm seeing this as really maybe the best hope that we have. We're not running our world well at all. We are truly flushing it right down the proverbial cosmic toilet. And
boy,
it's just
a mental image.
That's right.
I'm
and
sorry.
It's just possible that the development of the exponential development of computing intelligence might find us some answers that we're not getting right now. And I hope that that is the case. Because otherwise, I really don't know what else we're going to do.
Rich, I have a question from a listener. Someone wants to know whether you believe, what, in your opinion, which will be easier to force open the can, the alien can or the black government can?
Well, that's a great question.
Yeah.
They're related issues.
Which do you think people are likely to admit to first? Yeah. I'm thinking alien because that's something outside rather than the black government. It's more like personal wrongdoing, which people would be less willing to fess up to unless they have to.
Yeah, I think that that's true, but I also think that that's the reason the alien issue really hasn't been made public. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, that aliens are here. Okay. That doesn't sound so threatening to a lot of people. I mean, to some people, sure, but to a lot of people, I think they would be okay with that. And indeed, there's a lot of people who question the government's secrecy because they keep saying, well, the government should just treat us like adults. We can handle the fact that there may be aliens here, okay? You know, I'm a grown-up. I'm not 5 years old. To which I always say, true, and it's very likely that that is not the reason for the secrecy. Because if the president were to admit that aliens were here, you can't just let the issue go at that. But that acknowledgement will inevitably lead to a lot of other nasty little secrets, including black budget. I think that's an inevitability. Because one of the first things that people are going to ask is, oh, well, what about all these rumors, then, that you're replicating alien technology? Suddenly, these become very rational and plausible. And once you start going there, then you have to start asking, well, how have you been funding all this? Where is this money been coming from? And you start looking into it. And that, I think, is in danger of ripping open the secrecy. Now, there's a lot of other things that can open up the whole covert world, the whole black world topic. The 9/11 issue is one such issue that can do it. I mean, if people start getting into the problems of the 9/11 explanation as we have gotten it, and you start really digging, that's going to get you into black budget or black ops, very likely. So that could do it. You know, we really haven't had much public discourse on black budget almost at all, even in the 20 years since the concept's been out. There was a book in around 1990 that really introduced the whole idea of the black budget to the American people. I mean, before 1990, no one talked about a black budget. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Only 17 years ago. It was a book called Blank Check by a journalist named Tim Weiner. And it's a good book. But the point is that even since that book came out, I mean, he really, I think, lowballed black budget anyway by most estimates that I've been there. But there's been almost no journalistic follow-up and very little historical academic follow-up to the whole idea of a black budget. Like, what's in it, for example? responsible, I put that word in quotes, responsible journalists would argue, well, it's not our business. I mean, this is national security. I don't want to spill any secrets. You know what? What the hell?
National security is used more often to keep information from the citizens.
That's right.
Rather than to protect anybody. It's protecting the people who are robbing us. I mean, this is just ridiculous.
So, anyway, to answer the question, I don't know. I mean, you start dealing with the ET issue, it's going to lead you to black budget. And it's been my opinion for some time that this is the core reason why the UFO topic is still off limits. There's a lot of other things. Let's do a couple of other what-ifs. And these are what-ifs that I happen to believe are true. What if we have a secret space program right now? And people go, wow, a secret space program? Well, what would you use that for? That's a good question. What would we use it for? Well, let's do another what if. What if some of those alleged anomalies on Mars and on the moon are real anomalies, that is, product of an alien civilization? So, if you want to check out these anomalies, and you want to do it secretly, because you don't want to spill the beans on alien intelligence, then by definition you would really need a secret space program. And so, but once you start spending billions and billions on a secret space program, which presumably has way better technology than NASA, don't you think it would piss off a few people once that came out, like the people at NASA, who died, some of whom who died in shuttle accidents over the years? Holy smokes! If it comes out that all these years you had technology that was vastly superior, maybe safer, than what these poor astronauts on the Columbia and on the Challenger had. That's a political nightmare. No one's going to want to deal with that. So there's just a lot of practical political issues involved that have, it's beyond the whole issue of how do we enlighten the public about aliens. It's practical matters. Here's another one. This one was given to me by a very high-placed person who I think had a lot of reasons to know what he was talking about. And it's, let's say that I'm Contractor A, Military Contractor A, and you're Military Contractor B. Disclosure comes out, aliens are here, and I discover that you have been getting access from the government free alien technology so that you can do your own R&D, and that was an unfair competitive advantage. Would I want to institute a lawsuit against you? Well, it's believed by a lot of insiders that this would be a danger. Now, lawsuit, big deal, who cares, right?
Right.
But it's just one issue of many. Lawsuits is apparently a big worry among certain insiders that they would be liable to severe penalties, not just lawsuits, but criminal action, I'm sure.
It's interesting to think that there is something they're afraid of. I mean, I'd be thinking, oh, lawsuits, no big deal. They get tons of money, they can just stall it. It seems like things have come up in the past that never really go anywhere. I mean, the whole 9/11 thing. And I wanted to ask you, in terms of 9/11, you were talking about the black budget and some of these things coming out. Could you just run through the story about questions being asked about the budget just prior to 9/11? Because a lot of people listening probably have not heard this.
Yeah, I've mentioned this a number of times, but you can never mention it too many.
Absolutely.
A month and a half before 9/11, so in the middle of July of 01, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, was speaking before the House of Representatives about the fiscal year budget for the next year for the Pentagon. Keep in mind that this was the first year that the Bush administration was in power. So Rumsfeld was basically had inherited the Defense Department from the Clinton years, okay?
Right, so they're only about 6-7 months in. They really hadn't had time to make any changes. I mean, the situation at that time really couldn't be put down to them.
This was their first year to argue for, their budget for the next, because the 01 budget was a leftover from the Clinton administration that they had determined. So Rumsfeld's talking to Congress and talking about the mess he inherited. And toward the end of his testimony, and this is online, people, look this up. He says, according to some of our estimates, we cannot track $2.6 trillion in transactions, if that's believable. Now, to put that in perspective, $2.6 trillion was 8 times the Pentagon budget for 2001. Pentagon budget for 2001 was about $310 billion. The $2.6 trillion is about times 8 of that number. Now, you think, well, wait a minute, that doesn't even make sense. How could you possibly be dealing with a number that large? But here's the problem. That number was repeated by another member of Congress, like 2 minutes later in that testimony, and then was corrected in the one news article that covered this was several months later by CBS, and a Pentagon spokesman there said it was $2.3 trillion. So I don't think this was a mistake or a misstatement. But then the question arises, how is it possible to talk about numbers that large when you're dealing with the Pentagon? I mean, you go from $310 billion to something 8 times where you say, we don't know where this money is. This money is not trackable.
Just imagine us, anybody, any one of us listening, doing our taxes and telling the IRS, I can't track my money.
Yeah, let's say that your annual income is $60,000, you know, you combine household income. And then you tell the IRS, what's it, that time? I can't track about $500,000.
And they're just going to go away. They're going to say, oh, okay, don't worry about it. Which
dollars.
Is essentially what happened when Rumsfeld said it.
That's what he said. But then the connection with 9/11, though. Now, actually, I remember talking with Catherine Austin Fitz, who's probably of the people that I've spoken to. She was in the Bush administration back in the 89 and 93, and she knows all these black budget issues really well. So she learned about this right before 9/11, and her opinion was, holy smokes, this is going to bring the house down. This is all the stuff that I've been looking at. She talked about the loss of $3.3 trillion during the last 3 years of the Clinton administration. I mean, that's a lot of money. So she's thinking, wow. But then came 9/11, and that issue went off the table. Now, one of the things that writer Jim Mars has pointed out in some of his new research, and let me just, my quick caveat is, I really personally want to look into this more before I say that this is definitely true, but it has been claimed that the plane that hit the Pentagon hit the one area of the Pentagon where they were doing, where the financial records were being held. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. Now, of course.
So now either there really is no information to back up, I mean, for anyone to be able to answer any questions, or at the very least, there's perfect deniability. Even if those records do exist somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if they ever truly existed. One thing Catherine Pitts has often said is that the U.S. government is literally not auditable.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. It's almost designed that way.
Which is another thing I would love to see any of us tell the IRS.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And have them just say, oh, okay, well, never mind, sorry to bother you.
Now, bringing it back to exopolitics, because there's a very good segue here, and I know we're getting
We've got
to
about
the end.
2 minutes left.
Right, I realize that.
Okay.
Let's say we get disclosure, all right? We've got to realize that it's very unlikely that the disclosure is ever going to be complete. And it may not even be truthful. It may not even be accurate in a lot of ways. We have to be on our guard always. I mean, heck, 10 years ago, the CIA said that they were making a disclosure about UFOs. They said, oh, yeah, all those UFO sightings that you were seeing in the 50s, that was actually the U-2 plane. Now, that argument was a load of crap. It's still being promoted to this day. But the point is that the CIA thought that that was their disclosure. So any future disclosure by a government agency, we've got to look at very critically. People who are involved in doing research have got to especially be honest. and keep these guys honest, because it's very likely that there's going to be a lot of spin control. The whole abduction issue, the whole question of whether or not there's ever been a deal with extraterrestrials on abduction and technology, the whole question about underground bases, I mean, it goes on and on and on. And so that one disclosure, I think, has the potential to lead to more and more disclosures, as long as we, researchers and citizens, are vigilant. Otherwise, you know, the disclosure may not be all that we would like it to be, which is basically a revolutionary event that will transform our society into something just and good, which it is not now.
So it's true that the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, being a pain in the ass to the government and to the people who are in power. They don't want that. I keep thinking of people like Susan B. Anthony, who was a royal pain to a lot of people around her. She really was.
Yeah.
She was a difficult person. She was brilliant, but she was not easy. But it's people like that who are necessary to make changes.
And it's like, I'm going to quote another bumper sticker, well-behaved women never make history.
They don't, nor do well-behaved men.
Right. On that note, we need to end it for today, but I'm thinking we're going to have to do this again. I still feel like we just barely scratched the surface of this. Now, fortunately, you and I get to talk about this all the time. However, our listeners are going to miss out on some of this.
Well, have them write to either of us. I mean,
yeah.
You get a lot of correspondence, so do I. So can you give our email?
Yeah, actually, you can. Well, go to our website at keyholepublishing.com. And you can follow links from that to email either of us or
right.
both of us.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the best.
Yeah. Thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in today. This was great. Thank you, Rich. It was really fun going over the whole conference.
We had a good time. After we got through our initial techno troubles,
yeah.
Thank
you, Joe, for fixing our technical problems. I don't know what happened, but got it pulled together. So
we did all right.
That's great. He mentioned once he heard thunder, too, and I thought, oh, no. But everything was fine. Okay, everybody. Thanks for joining us. This is Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan. My guest today was Rich Dolan, and we were talking about the X Conference in Gaithersburg, Maryland. There's going to be another X Conference in April, also in Gaithersburg. So if you want to find out more about that, get on the website and start looking up information on the X Conference. I'm going to put up a link on our site. And you can also go to PRG.com for ParadigmResearchGroup.com.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks.